Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hey, what's up? This is Jack Inslee, host of Full Service Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this show, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers by young farmers. Today we're very happy, I'm very happy, to be in the telephone virtual world of radio making with my friend Evan, who I just reconnected with after 10 years of sustained activism in our separate fields, in our separate geographies. Our geographies reconnected, and so did we. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Severin.
How are you doing down there?
I'm doing good. We're in dry Southern California. Where are you at?
I'm in slightly moist Central California.
Yeah, you're in Ojai?
I'm in Piscines, California, which is like Monterey level.
Oh, fun.
Tell me, what's going on down there at the Ecology Center?
Big picture or small picture?
Start big.
Well, just general orientation on our work. We're a little eco-education center, 1 acre kind of demonstration site on all things an ecological design orientation. And we're on a really great larger landscape. It's a 26-acre working organic farm, which is super rare in this built environment of Southern California. So we've kind of over the years taken a dirt lot into a thriving education and community center, and we do many, many things here, but they all ultimately revolve around hands-on ecological solutions and community building.
So what he's talking about is this super beautiful little white Victorian house that I think might have been kind of smelling like bats and rats when you guys moved in,
yeah,
and is now super hip and cool and teaching lots of workshops and all restored and groovy as like a cool kid clubhouse of regenerative practice. Now that you've done so much, what are you going to do next?
Well, you know, we both are family members of Camp Joy, right? And so I went to UC Santa Cruz, and then after Camp Joy, I farmed in Latin America and consulted on projects in West Africa for about 5.5 years. And then ultimately, all of that was broad-acre ecological design, so designing literally 1,000-acre kind of integrated agriculture projects, other types of developments, but all revolving around land management. And I guess kind of had this larger calling, which was about longer-term commitments and community impact, and it just felt like coming back home to Orange County, as scary as that was going to be the path of that is the path I chose, versus going and taking on some work in West Africa to model what sustainable agriculture looked like. I figured, might as well do it in my backyard.
Well, and this describes the pathway of many young agrarians in our listener base who are navigating their own pathway and career trajectory through sustainable agriculture. Evan and I both started as apprentices at this really wonderful organic farm in the hills above Santa Cruz called Camp Joy, which does biodynamic and, I don't know, more than biodynamic, but special permanent beds and Alan Chadwick style gardens and bouquets and vegetable production and goats. And then you went off into the wild world in a pretty big way. Wow.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always, you know, Santa Cruz was a great learning environment really is a hotbed and epicenter for the sustainable ag conversation and movement, and always felt like, I got the training wheels off and had to figure it out and actually create communities like that other places. And it's been a really fun journey to be a pioneer of bringing what sustainable ag looks like to communities, whether, you know, far remote regions of Costa Rica or kind of the more developed areas of Nigeria, but it ultimately ended up in Orange County, which is also equally as crazy.
Well, and so one thing that's true in the circuit I run, spending time in some of the hotbed places in Vermont and northern, and you know, Hudson Valley and Northern California and Upper Midwest, and meeting a bunch of young farmers who are working in these more lauded and established venues of sustainable ag, and working with some of our real mentors in the elder community, or our elders in organic ag, is then meeting those same people out in unexpected places, you know, in Iowa and rural Wisconsin, and that dispersal that is going on of this movement. And I wonder if you could reflect, you know, and so then just being in, you know, in Baltimore and in Philadelphia and seeing all the urban ag happening there, and then, you know, it's happening in Charlottesville, it's happening in Nashville, it's happening, and you kind of blink your eyes and all of a sudden all of these places that didn't used to be, you know, super hubs have, you know, multiple staff positions in city government that have to do with urban agriculture and with urban access to compost and with nutrition programs linked in with hospitals. And, you know, the thing is happening and in all sorts of places. Can you talk a little bit about your area and where it was and what you've seen and how long of a time in order to maybe embolden those who are midway in their career and have gone out and learned a bunch of training and who might, like you, be inspired to go back to their home place and engage?
Yeah, I mean, even just speaking for over the last 7 years since starting this, the Ecology Center, you know, Orange County, to set the tone for those that don't know the geography here, we're between L.A. and San Diego, and there's about 3.5 million people in a pretty densely packed area without any real substantial agriculture. So there's a complete disconnect to our environment within the demographic here. So, you know, I wasn't certain that this would have been a successful model when I started, and that people were even interested in the conversation. And our conversation is larger than just growing food, or not that that's not an incredibly large conversation, but our conversation here at the center is really about connecting people to decision making that helps support local farmers and gets these celebrated chefs to be using product that is grown with integrity in a local radius, and obviously programming that's kind of models all of that stuff. So to be honest, the community has grown a lot really quick with us, but there's an example in Orange County where you would think the demographic wouldn't be resonating with, this type of work is extremely, extremely engaged, and the demand is humongous. I mean, not just here, but I think I would assume in every community people are trying to grasp with what is this new lexicon of living and how do we participate in it. So ultimately it all comes back to how do we make a fun, creative experience for people.
Well, and so that's something I think you're super good at, and, you know, my praise is generally a little bit salty, but holy moly, it's so awesome there, and everything looks great, and the pedagogy that you adopted, your method for giving your participants or your visitors a really incredibly hands-on experience, is like the best natural history museum of organic agriculture ever, with amazing exhibits. Can you talk about your kind of pedagogical approach? And, you know, you partner with brands, you partner with designers, you make all these awesome three-dimensional exhibits.
Yeah. I feel like that's crucial, not just for us as an education center, but I think that's crucial for the 21st century, is that we have the ability to use the resources, tools, and expertise around us to create compelling products or organizations or programs that can compete with basically any brand, right? Why wouldn't we have the tools around us, so that could be design or that could be, you know, the educational capacity of our work or the community building piece, but there's so many capable people. We just need to put the pieces together. And so I think that's always been, from my perspective, there's an aesthetic disconnect with this sustainability movement in general. And I think that now that we're in the 21st century, we can't think that that's okay. We need to kind of actually meet the general community where they're at with what they're comfortable with just a different type of program and experience. And so, yeah, we work with all sorts of amazing artists and designers and have focused on that since the very beginning to create a world-class center that doesn't have any barriers of entry ultimately.
Well, and of course, you know, dorky peaceniks will always make ugly flyers, but we have the potential to make non-ugly flyers and more groovy, design-forward products, especially as our new economy is allowing for more flexibility and kind of hybridity in terms of career for the movement as a whole. And I'm talking about small towns being places where people who are graphic designers can work not only in Orange County, but that's totally true even in less urban settings, that there's a bunch of skills around and that connecting them to each other is one of the core skill sets of rebuilding regional
resilience.
Yeah, and
I think these are translatable to not just a community center, education center like this, but to a farm, right? So every farm needs to have a relationship to at least one chef, and that's not selling produce. That's actually modeling how do you most appropriately use that food. So it's having dinners or, you know, cooking classes. You need to have a relationship to a designer to make sure that the branding is sophisticated. You know, all of these other pieces that are already inherent within any community, rural or urban, that's sort of the net, and that's where I think as, you know, I talk about that a little bit when I have permaculture students, is that, hey, not everyone needs to be a farmer, right? You know, be good at something. If you're already good at something like design or culinary or whatever it might be, finances, like just choose how do you integrate the right thing into that profession. So it's about partnerships and collaboration, I think.
So tell us what's coming along. I like your tactic. I like your how you do it. And I think people also who are listening will like it. What's coming up next for you? What kind of programs are you offering? What's the demand that you see coming around the corner now that you're 7 years in? How does your program evolve?
Yeah, so ultimately our programming is evolving into how do we facilitate a community movement. So instead of us developing workshops, skills-based learning, publications or events, we're doing that also, but it's really more about how do we create a concerted effort of the most amount of people. And I don't know if that is that, depending on the program, how we define the number, it's not necessarily a huge volume, it's just people working in connection to each other. So, for example, we have been working to mentor the school garden community throughout the region. And so we train up teachers, we help design their gardens, we give them technical skills, we help write curriculum, but ultimately we are like the hub. And so now what we're trying to do in that program is not just mentor a few dozen schools, is actually how do we create a mechanism or a community that mentors themselves so that that could scale over time. Meaning, like, we ultimately just want this idea of ecosystem development. So growing food and planting fruit trees and composting your waste and harvesting your rainwater, all to be connected everywhere. And then as that becomes infectious, then it's obvious that our schools will be the benefit of that, because our parents that are engaged and our children engaged at their houses are going to demand that in their schools. So that's probably a little convoluted, but that's some of the ideas of how we think of sustaining an idea so it's not just on the back of our organization.
Well, and, you know, there's the evolution of a model, you know, Saul Alinsky and a lot of the community organizer role traditionally has been for an organizer or an activist to go into a community and figure out what that community needs and go about setting up systems for that community to provide for itself or to articulate its need in such a way that it's met. And it seems like that's, you know, in terms of resilience-based organizing or regenerative-based organizing, that that's one of the core tactics, is helping connect the parts of the community together in order to enact or prototype and then enact solutions that work for a large number of people and that are self-perpetuating.
I think it's more exciting that way, as opposed to, you know, one organization think that to scale you just have to add more people. And, you know, you just have to think creatively about it. How do you make more impact without adding more people, more resources type of thing?
Well, and, you know, one of the big reasons I'm so into The Grange is that The Grange is a communitarian-shaped organization that's a lot more horizontal in terms of who are the beneficiaries and who are the protagonists of the programming, and that the leadership is much more, much broader than one, you know, one executive director and then some program people and then everything kind of deploying out like from a stereo. But instead it's more of a circle, like a circular stereo. And it feels like that, especially in times when there's more constraint around philanthropy dollars, that those more community-based or communitarian-type institutions have a greater potential for being durable. Anyway, your building looks like a Grange, and we had a really fun time coming there with our Grange Future Tour.
Yeah, that was so awesome.
Which gives me a good moment to plug the fact that Grange Future Tour is going to Oregon next month, February, and we're screening the Up Up Farm Film Festival in, I think, nine different Granges. So anyway, if you're in Oregon or if you want to plug in with that,
think about us. Maybe there's a possible next summer we can do some screenings as well.
Cool. Yeah, in the summer in Southern California is a good time to go indoors and eat popsicles.
It's true. Or go outdoors and just wait for the sun to fall.
Yeah. What else is coming up on your horizon? What else are you thinking about or seeing that wants
to get organized? I mean, there's some really big ideas for how do we, you know, I just got out of a meeting actually with a group of really smart people that I have around me that I'm fortunate to have good advisors around me, but thinking about how do we help facilitate, articulate, and organize, if you will, the local food movement here at large. So we're just kind of thinking about what is the long-term commitment and strategy look like for us to make a larger difference? Like, do we take on farming as a model and really show best practices in this climate, or do we more create a hub for and a network and distribution around local farmers connecting to the you know, consumers and or restaurants, et cetera, that are interested in these products and just trying to amplify the message. So I think that's ultimately what big picture is, just trying to figure out how do we get good food in the hands of more people and all unify that message. And there's a lot of other smaller things that we're working on as well.
Well, and, you know, Southern California, what I'm looking at right now in Central California is hundreds of acres of lettuce and irrigated perishable vegetable crops that are one of the mainstays of California agriculture and which are increasingly not appropriate to a drought-stricken region or just droughtier region.
Yeah.
That's what the kind of long-term projections are for California generally, is less water overall. Pretty reliable models according to the climate science conference that I went to. And so the question for organizing, and especially future-looking organizing about resilient food systems, is what does transition look like? What does experimentation look like in terms of the kinds of crops and cropping systems that are more weather-appropriate or climate-appropriate or drought-appropriate
yeah,
than all this freaking baby lettuce?
I know. Well, that's the million-dollar question, too, which is, can we eat climate-appropriate crops? For example, when I lived and worked in tropical Latin America for 5.5 years, and when you're in the tropics, it's a completely different pattern of agriculture. It's all tree-based. It looks like a rainforest, so it's agroforestry at large, and then the diversity is totally different. Even in terms of your vegetables, you're mostly eating greens that come from trees, and you're eating a lot of starch and root crops that are understory. And so even at large scale, you just have to change your diet. But what's interesting, I would see with a lot of people that were also from Western places that were living in the tropics, they would bring their lettuce seeds, or they would bring their, you know, even their European root crops, and try to grow those in the tropics and just put so much energy into it, mostly backyard gardeners, and not have any success. And it was just, that's the hard cultural shift of, are you willing to eat climate-appropriate plants? And it was hard to see that in the tropics, and it'll be interesting, can we push that forward here in the Tampa region?
Well, and, you know, olive oil isn't so controversial, but once you start talking about, like, carob or ice cream beans, that starts getting out of people's comfort zone. I guess that would be another place for the chef is being really well in cahoots with some of the experimental growers and really championing those growers who are experimenting with some of those crops to support the kind of R&D that they're doing on behalf of the larger bioregion.
Yeah, why is olive controversial?
Olives are not. I think olives are like the least controversial droughty crop there is.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. I mean, there's so many great. I think of the pattern. It looks, you know, what are people in Greece? What are people in Morocco? What are, you know, places in these places that are very similar to Southern California? And you're going to get amazing diversity. And that's for us, you know, in a place where we don't have water resources to speak of, underground or in, you know, local basins of any note, then we have to think about agriculture shifting, you know. And even though we can grow avocados at scale, and we can grow, you know, you name it, tropical fruit, because it doesn't freeze deep San Diego, kind of Southern California, then we might not be able to afford that from a water perspective, and so it might look like a shift.
Well, and, you know, I was just watching this cool movie called The Big Short, where those guys were basically betting against the housing market, and then they won. And there was one guy who was like, you know, even if you're right, if you're too early, that could be wrong. And even if you're right, if you're too late, that could be wrong. And, you know, one of the big questions as young farmers starting businesses struggle with how our marketplace values their goods and struggle with really high land costs and struggle with the labor price being artificially low because of poor rates for labor and in a lot of immigrant labor that is undervalued. It's almost like just because you know, being early can feel wrong. And I wonder, however, how in terms of climate, that we can better align incentives where being early, you know, has a more direct payoff for those who are taking risks and looking ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have an answer to that question. It's more of a philosophical question. Is, you know, how are we at better able to value, appreciate, reward those who are thinking ahead in these terms?
Yeah,
We could create some kind of a crown, like a crowning, like a ceremony.
Well, I think you have to find the right, you know, there's a great market for specialty products and especially climate appropriate specialty products. You know, I always lean on our culinary community, you know, all these great restaurants that want to do the right thing, and for us in our region don't have access to great product. So I think that's the incentive, is that, you know, that's the niche, that's the advantage that a farmer would have by doing the right thing, is one, it's storytelling, but two, it's a unique product.
Yeah, if you're the only one growing sapote or ice cream bean or making homemade carob, that you could sell it in the more fancy category,
right?
Direct market to chefs.
Yeah, I mean, even just, you know, I look at towards other Mediterranean crops. What can we do with pomegranates and figs and mulberries and all that kind of stuff? You know, how do we, can we push that further and we actually celebrate that as a society, that those are the plants that grow best here?
So, you know, and looking not only across the Mediterranean regions, but you're there and right next to the mission, the Padres who were setting up the trade route during the time of the colonial period of Spain, trading up and down the coast of California, each of the missions within a mule day journey of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they were growing a lot of wheat and exporting a lot of wheat and dry beans.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, our friend Alex Weiser, I don't know if you know him, amazing farmer out of his distributions in L.A., and he's in Tehachapi, but he's doing some really cool grain work and trying to bring back the idea that they call it the Golden State because there used to be so much grain, and it is a dry land crop. So there is an appropriate annual rotation as well.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. More beans are always good.
More beans are always good. Well, it's really nice to see. I mean, I just, you know, get coming into a decade in this work and seeing how kind of cosmopolitan the Young Farmers Movement is, how many people move around and cross-pollinate, and how well information flows across geographies and up and down scales of work and fluidly between organizations. And anyway, I am really impressed with how networked the network is.
Yeah.
And I just hope we can keep growing and faster and faster.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I said thanks to you for leading, helping organize that, and it's a massive undertaking, and it's really important work.
Really important work. Let it continue. So thank you all for listening, and please do keep tuning in, because we have this new film festival that we're peddling. It's about 17 films. Maybe it's 17 and a half films, because there's some that are short. And they're all young farmer films, and they're all oriented at young audiences who are considering a career in agriculture and the factors that determine how that career will go, similar to the Greenhorns film, but more, and some of them even much better. And it's called Up Up Farm Film Festival, and you or your town or your library or your Rotary Club or your Grange or your community center or your church could host that. And if you've never organized anything before, take it from me, take it from Mark, from Evan, you can learn how to organize. It's not rocket science. And starting with something pretty manageable like a film festival and having something concrete to do, like talk together in a group of people that you may or may not know, eating popcorn about topics of relevance to the landscape around you, is as good a way to start as any. Community is a prerequisite to almost every action. So, anywho, there's my pitch.
I love
Up Farm Film Festival. You got any pitches or upcoming events you want to call out, Evan?
We got a really cool, if you're local, we do a lot of really great skills-based workshops, and we're doing a lot of work around rainwater harvesting this season. So if you want a really great discounted rain barrel or need some guidance on anything around water, that's the season for us. And then we're doing a lot of farm dinners. We have Chez Panisse coming down in 2 weeks for a dinner, and then a bunch of amazing chefs kind of every month. So if you guys are in the Southern California region, check it out. It's our community table series and all that work and more.
And if you're freaked out by the traffic, you can get there by train.
Yes, exactly. Right here in San Juan Capistrano.
San Juan Capistrano. You can take your bike on the Amtrak. No problem.
No problem. Yeah, check it out, theecologycenter.org. There's a the in front. It's a complicated
All right, part. Everybody. Thank you for your attention again. And this is something like our 262nd episode. Starting to get
Thanks,
into
Severin.
A real rhythm here. Thank you, Evan.
All right, talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.